Oh, well, awesome. Thanks everyone for coming today for the penultimate and maybe ultimate RevConf session, but that's up to you to decide, I think. So yeah, today I'm going to be talking about the question of did Lenin lead to Stalin? I think just to contextualize and introduce a bit why it's worth having this talk, it's basically taken as political common sense across actually the majority of the political spectrum to see that actually Lenin did lead to Stalin. So on the right, you have outright reactionaries and right wingers who of course see some, socialism as inherently synonymous with dictatorship. So yes, of course, Lenin led to Stalin. Then you have liberals and reformists in the center who go, well, maybe, revolutionary stuff would be good ideas, but they're doomed to defeat, doomed to dictatorship. So yes, Lenin did lead to Stalin. Then you have Stalinists who say, well, yes, of course, Stalin's dictatorship was the natural and logical and correct outcome of Lenin and the Russian Revolution. So therefore, Lenin did lead to Stalin. Well, I'm here today to try and refute every single one of those arguments, basically. The way that I'm going to be doing that is by kind of explaining, first of all, the Russian Revolution and also kind of going through what made that so different to the Stalinist society that followed. Because at the center of the Russian Revolution, really, what its essence was the establishment of a democratic working class control over society. But within a few short years, this system of democratic control had been crushed, not from the outside, as many revolutionaries had expected, but from within, in the form of a dictatorship headed by the Bolshevik Party, now renamed the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, the same party which had actually led the October Revolution. So how did this turnabout happen? Well, the first and most important factor was the failure of the revolution to spread internationally from Russia. So the Russian economy was relatively backwards compared to its Western European counterparts, which made the question of its economic isolation extremely important. So in 1918, Lenin, with tragic foresight, argued that the absolute truth is that without a revolution in Germany, we shall perish. So a revolution was actually, in fact, on the order of the day across Europe. So there were explosions of revolutions and revolts in Germany, Austria, Poland, Italy, Hungary, and more. There were even, brief, shortly-lived Soviet republics, just like in Russia. But none of them were able to recreate what had happened in Russia, which was putting workers in charge. The failure of these other revolutions to put workers in charge, seriously deprived the Soviet state and Russia of the economic resources it needed to actually survive, to weather the storm. So this lack of international support led into the second factor, which was the political situation inside Russia during and after the years of civil war. So to say that the situation inside Russia was dire would be to grossly understate it, actually. The scale of societal collapse, when you read about it, it's actually quite shocking. During the civil war, at times, it reminds you of an apocalyptic situation, actually, how much society was basically collapsing. There were so many different various intersecting crises that were just completely wrecking the revolution. I'll put up this slide of some various statistics you can have a look at of what was going on in the economy. I'll summarize some of them. But the most important single crisis of what was going on in Russia was the complete collapse of the economy, which began as soon as the early months of 1918. So World War I, even before the revolution had broken out, had already wreaked havoc in the economy, particularly in the railways and in transportation. So the demand of the armies for World War I, in foodstuffs, combined with a huge disruption in agricultural output, which was caused by the conscription of millions and millions and millions of young men who were peasants into the army, created a huge decline in the output of food, as well as its availability for workers in the industrial cities. So then the civil war actually began after, the Bolsheviks took power in October and kicked basically all of these economic problems into absolute overdrive. So there were whole, swathes of the country that were lost to counter-revolutionary white armies or foreign capitalist powers, often for years at a time. So there's a map up here, which, kind of shows the most extreme ends of it. There were times where it was basically reduced to very small parts of Russia, a period that, spaces that the Bolsheviks actually controlled. Just as one single example, one of the most extreme examples, in early 1918, the Soviet state was forced to sign a peace deal with Germany, which exited them from World War I, which was good because it fulfilled the demand of peace. But they were forced to do so at a tremendous cost. They had to surrender over a quarter of their land and 44% of their population to German occupation, which was also about a third of all food production 73% of their iron production, 75% of their coal, and over half of their total industry. So this German occupation was absolutely, you know, crazy in terms of the havoc it wreaked on the economy. It only lasted a year. It ended, thankfully, due to the arrival of the German Revolution, in which workers overthrew the Kaiser. But this just one episode is kind of indicative of the extreme pressure that the revolution was under militarily. And there are lots of other small case examples throughout the Civil War up till 1921 of very important parts of the economy just being lost to counter-revolutionary armies. So in total, there were not only the white counter-revolutionary armies, but also 13 foreign armies, which basically directly intervened in Russia to fight the Red Army over the course of the Civil War, including, of course, Germany, but also the UK, America, France, and even Australia sent troops to fight the Red Army. So this military situation contributed to even further economic chaos. So there was mass unemployment in the cities for thousands of workers who found that their factories could simply no longer function because they didn't have fuel to, you know, fuel the industry, nor did they have the actual, you know, natural resources to produce commodities or anything at all, basically. Thousands of workers basically lost their jobs. An economic blockade by the capitalist world also meant that imports and exports fell to basically zero in the course of the Civil War, so they couldn't make up for any of their lost production. So by 1920, industrial production had declined to just 12.9% of the 1913 level. So literally, the economy was a tenth of what it had been. So the result was famine. In Moscow at that time, the average Russian had only a seventh of the average calorie intake of a German and only a tenth of an average British person. And that was under war rations in Germany and Britain. So really, really terrible. So the sheer physical exhaustion of workers was actually one of the driving, you know, compounding factors in the collapsing economy. And productivity absolutely just went through the floor, basically. So 35 million people, or a quarter of the Russian population, suffered from acute and continuous hunger during the Civil War. So, and from this mass, you know, hunger followed, of course, epidemics on the vulnerable population. So from 1918 to 1920, over 5 million people fell ill with typhus, of whom 1.6 million died. So in this two-year period alone, from 1918 to 1920, there were over 7 million premature deaths from hunger and disease. So then there were the military casualties of the Civil War itself, which I haven't gone to yet, which were lower at around 355,000 people, but were very, very significant in terms of who was fighting and dying. So the Red Army was largely recruited from the trade unions. In fact, about 50% of the total trade union membership were recruited into the Red Army to defend the revolution. So the ranks of the Red Army were often filled with, you know, at the best and the brightest of among the working class, those who had played the leading role in the 1917 revolution, the really outstanding members of the working class, many of whom would never, you know, return from the front lines of the Civil War. So owing to the kind of, you know, Herculean sacrifices of the working class during the Civil War, the Soviet government did actually manage to stave off complete military destruction. They won the Civil War. But in the course of this, the working class had completely burned itself out in the process. So for those workers who survived, unemployment and the search for food led to a mass exodus from the cities to the countryside. The population of the cities collapsed as a result. So in the capital of Petrograd, which had been just over 2,400,000 people, fell to only 574,000 people. And the population of the various provincial capitals fell by 33% in total. The number of industrial workers, who are, of course, the heart of the revolution and the mainstay of support for the Bolshevik party, collapsed as well. So in, across the whole of Russia, it fell from 3 million industrial workers in 1917 to under 1,250,000 in 1921. So in Petrograd, you know, the heart of the revolution, the 400,000 industrial workers of 1917 collapsed to only 71,000 employed workers by April 1918. So not even 6 months after the October Revolution. That's how really rapidly this crisis was taking place. So what did this economic disaster actually mean for the revolution, which primarily was the workers' organizations, the Soviets, and the factory councils, which had actually come to power in 1917? Well, the economic and social bonds that had tied workers together, which had molded them into a class which was capable of setting up these institutions like the Soviets and the factory councils, these social bonds began to completely fall apart. So the working class had basically actually largely ceased to function as a class, which was united. So for example, most workers no longer relied on their wage as the primary means of meeting their own subsistence. Instead, they were forced to individually trade for goods or barter, and some workers were even, you know, forced to steal goods from work just to sell them in order to survive. So the extent to which workers were united by a common collective interest basically declined massively, which meant that this class, which was supposed to be ruling this new socialist society, disintegrated as a united political force. It was out of this disintegration that a new layer of state administrators and bureaucrats emerged. So the Bolshevik Party, you know, with, you know, the decline of the working class aside, were tenaciously holding out, hoping for international revolution to save them. And in the process of this, they were forced to increasingly substitute themselves for the role that workers had previously played. So many of those who staffed these new state bureaucracies were, you know, genuine revolutionaries, but who gradually had their interests and their social outlook changed as their social position objectively changed. So while the working class fragmented, the Bolshevik Party was transformed from a mass party of the working class into one in which state bureaucrats, factory managers, government officials, army officials, and party officials dominated in reality. While this was happening, the Bolsheviks were also forced to make various political concessions in the course of the Civil War, which compounded the growth of this bureaucratic layer. So one example was the gradual banning of other political parties from the Soviets, like the Mensheviks and SRs, for the simple reason that, well, they actually didn't support a Soviet victory in the Civil War. Actually, the bottom line of what was happening was you either support the Soviets coming to power or you don't, and the Mensheviks and the SRs simply didn't. So they were forced to ban these other political parties. This left the Bolsheviks with a de facto, you know, political monopoly on power, one which they've never desired from the outset. And they, in fact, even amended their political program, their, you know, party constitution at this time to state that they would reverse this at a later date once the situation was better. But history was to have other plans, basically. So this situation of, you know, de facto one-party control of government, combined with the growth of this huge, you know, really, really rapidly growing state bureaucracy, further atrophied the already weakened workers' councils, already weakened Soviets, leading to the gradual disappearance of any real distinctions between the Soviets and the Bolshevik Party. So the introduction of the new economic policy in 1921, or the NEP, was another such concession that the Bolsheviks had to make. The NEP basically allowed for the re-emergence of parts of the capitalist market, which was introduced after the Civil War ended, basically just to desperately try and give the economy some kind of a kickstart. But as a side effect, it gave birth to the NEP men, or Nepmen, I don't actually know how to pronounce it, who were rich private traders or rich peasants who were basically profiting from this new market. These NEP men influenced factory managers and state functionaries who gradually began to enrich themselves off the back of a reviving economy. In fact, in this period, a new word even entered the lexicon of Soviet workers, which was sovbua, which was short for Soviet bourgeois, which were those who were benefiting from this kind of trickle of special privileges. So this growing wealth inequality accelerated the process of class differentiation, which was emerging between the state bureaucracy and the working class. This process would ultimately result in the state bureaucracy becoming self-conscious of their class interests. So the final victory of this, you know, burgeoning ruling class, you know, was not achieved in a day. It took years, actually, for this new social layer to completely cohere itself and impose its will on society. So Lenin himself had actually become aware of this bureaucratic distortion, as he called it, within the party, and tried to organize, you know, a faction against it to try and fight back. But it was simply too late. The rot had already set in. And he died quite quickly in 1924 after a series of strokes. So Joseph Stalin, having been appointed General Secretary of the Communist Party in 1922, became the personification of this state bureaucracy's social interests, which he would safeguard for the rest of his life. So why Stalin? Why Stalin the individual? Well, he was actually quite unexceptional as a single, you know, individual person, which I'm not just saying because I don't like him. It's true. He hadn't really in the, you know, Russian Revolution been a leader of any real note. In fact, if you read, you know, the book, 10 Days That Shook the World by John Reed, he's only mentioned once as part of a list of, various officials, within the Bolshevik Party or various leaders. So he wasn't a very noteworthy leader, but he had the basically prestige of being an old Bolshevik within the party. He'd been around for a long time. And more importantly, he had very close bonds inside the political machine of the Communist Party. So through Stalin, the bureaucracy saw their ticket to basically set themselves adrift from socialist principles and from any notion that, you know, the masses of working class people should actually control the state. So in early 1923, Lenin had even written a letter, sometimes referred to as his last testament, urging that Stalin be removed from his position as general secretary, a letter which was suppressed and not made public till many years later. So it took about 5 minutes after Lenin's death for Stalin to completely break with Marxist principles, with the announcement of socialism in one country. So completely spurning decades of Marxist politics and principle and internationalism, Stalin renounced the notion that building socialism depended on international revolution, which had been Marxist orthodoxy, Bolshevik orthodoxy for years. Instead, he argued that socialism could be built in Russia alone. So what did this mean? Well, the announcement of socialism in one country, it wasn't just a different strategy to get to socialism. What it represented was, in a sense, a declaration of independence by the Russian state bureaucracy that their narrow sectional interests as the Russian state now took precedence over the interests of the workers of the world. So socialism in one country was a political turn, a very significant one, which signaled two long-lasting impacts. So firstly, in order to build socialism in one country, as they called it, it meant intensifying exploitation of workers inside Russia in order to strengthen the economy for the bureaucracy. Secondly, it meant the complete subordination of the international communist movement and the international workers' movement to the narrow geopolitical interests of the Russian state. So by this point of the early 1920s, the bureaucracy was firmly in control of the party through Stalin, but had not yet completely wiped out internal opposition. So throughout the 1920s, there were a series of inter-party battles that took place in the Communist Party, with most of the attacks and kind of ire directed against the left opposition, which was headed by Leon Trotsky, who basically, you know, the left opposition was about upholding the legacy of the Russian Revolution and hoping to one day reintroduce things like workers' democracy and so on. So revolutionaries in the left opposition were gradually removed from their positions and replaced by Stalin loyalists, and were at times even internally exiled inside the Soviet Union to get them out of Stalin's way, or in the case of Trotsky, literally deported from the country. So, you know, through this kind of inter-party, you know, maneuvering and battling, the bureaucracy were ultimately able to conquer the party, not with the strength of their ideas, but with its own institutional strength and social strength to simply remove and appoint whoever it chose. So despite the kind of, you know, endless deification of Lenin and the 1917 revolution that, you know, came afterwards, nobody who actually advocated a return to the principles and the ideals of 1917 were allowed to remain prominent inside the Bolshevik Party. They were simply removed from prominence. So in 1928, Stalin announced what was called the first of his five-year plans, which was basically a project of breakneck industrialization designed to catch up with the capitalist West. So for the first time, the bureaucracy had basically actively set about to mold society in its own image instead of just floating along controlling this society that they'd inherited from the revolution. So for this reason, I basically think that this moment is extremely important in that it represents, I think, the final break with the revolution, as it meant that government deliberately had to reverse the gains that workers still had from 1917. So, for example, before this, throughout the 1920s, increases in productivity in the economy had led to corresponding increases in living standards for workers. But the path of hyperindustrialization meant the opposite, which was an immense increase in exploitation. So wages were massively driven down, and on the workplace level, production was seriously intensified. Workers were pushed harder and harder at work, often through the introduction of piecework, where you weren't paid by the hour, you were paid by how much you produced, which was like really like early Industrial Revolution stuff, really terrible. So this period also saw the establishment of the Gulag system, infamous, of course, which was basically the forced slave labor of millions of people, including of tens of thousands of political dissidents, including many former left oppositionists who were very famously sent to the Volkhuta Gulag. Many of these, yeah, basically slaves is what they basically were worked to death building infrastructure projects at the behest of Stalin, projects which were essential for this five-year plan. So at the same time, while all of this is going on, there was a new need to feed the cities because this massive industrialization meant a growing population of the cities. So to this end, the government implemented a forced collectivization of agriculture, basically pushing millions of peasants into inefficient, poorly planned and under-mechanized collective farms, which were completely unable to match the tempo of industrial expansion. So this process of removing peasants from their land to develop capitalism, develop industry basically, was called primitive accumulation by Marx in his day. And it, in countries like Britain, had taken over 100 years to really finish. In Russia, it took about 5 years. It was forcibly condensed into this very short period of time. So basically meant a very violent seizure of grain from the peasants to feed the cities, which backfired horribly, leaving most peasants without any motive to continue working because they couldn't sell their produce for anyone. It was just taken from them. This basically ground agriculture to a halt with very dire circumstances. For the first time since the Civil War, there were massive famines in the Soviet Union, particularly in Ukraine, where most food production happened. All the food was shipped out of Ukraine to feed the major Russian cities. The exact numbers are difficult and vary quite a lot, but at least somewhere from 2 to 4 million people died in this period from the combination of famine, cold disease, and government repression. So despite this tremendous human cost, the five-year plan was successful from the point of view of the state bureaucracy in that it had gifted them a strong industrial base to compete against the West with, both economically and militarily. So the Russian state was only growing actually stronger and stronger. Far from this economic growth, you know, leading to some kind of a relaxing of government control or authoritarianism, the 1930s actually signaled the peak of this kind of like high Stalinist period of totalitarian rule over society. The years from 1936 to 1938 in particular saw the Great Purge, in which 700,000 people were killed in basically this mass government repression. So this repression was inflicted throughout society against workers, peasants, also ethnic minorities were particularly targeted. But most famously were the rigged show trials, which were basically sham trials of well-known figures in the Communist Party and the military high command. The guilty verdicts in these trials, in which people were confused, like accused of the most ridiculous crimes imaginable, like collaborating with the Nazis and all this ridiculous stuff. The verdicts in these trials almost always relied on forced confessions, often extracted through torture. Many of the victims of these trials were those who had been the leading revolutionaries in 1917. In fact, that was very deliberate. As you can see up here, there's a bit of an indication of some figures who died. Of Lenin's, Central Committee of 1917, the Central Committee of the Bolshevik Party, the majority of those who remained, who were still alive in Russia, were tried and executed, even former allies of Stalin, like Bukharin. So Leon Trotsky, who had been exiled and who had kept up the fight against Stalin in exile, was assassinated in 1940 by one of Stalin's agents. I think if there's any, you know, one single proof, one piece of evidence I had to use to, you know, prove that there was no political lineage between Lenin and Stalin, that there was in fact a break between them, it would be that Stalin had to literally physically murder the entire generation of Lenin's contemporaries. Through murdering his former comrades, basically, Stalin had murdered the memory of the revolution itself, leaving himself kind of unchallenged, in his Orwellian project, really, to rewrite history, in which he kind of retroactively designated himself as the true heir of Lenin, which leads to so much of the common idea this day of that, you know, Lenin led a Stalin, which Stalin deliberately fostered that idea to justify his regime. So throughout the Stalinist period, every remnant of the Russian Revolution and its liberatory ideals and gains were crushed one by one. So class inequalities and social oppressions were restored, quite gradually over the Stalinist period. So 10 to 15% of the population enjoyed as much wealth as the bottom 80%, which was just as much, if not more, unequal than the Western capitalist states. State bureaucrats enjoyed special privileges, luxuries like access to cars, vacations, nice apartments, not to mention obviously obscene salaries. Ranks in the armies were restored, abolishing the rights of soldiers to elect their own commanding staff, which had been a very important part of the Russian Revolution. Autonomy for the oppressed nationalities were basically torn up in favor of de facto Russian dominance within the USSR. Not to mention after World War II, Russian dominance over all of Eastern Europe, which was gained and maintained through the barrels of Russian guns. So abortion was recriminalized in 1936 after having been legalized basically for the first time in the whole world in 1920 by the Bolsheviks. The state basically in general actually went extremely backwards on women's rights. So they made it more difficult for women to obtain divorces from their husbands by making a money payment a prerequisite for divorce, where previously you could just do it if you wanted to get a divorce. Stalin even, this is particularly gross, in a mirror image of something that Hitler had done in Germany, Stalin introduced a medal, something called the Order of Maternal Glory, which was awarded to women who had 7 children or more. So basically like deliberately encouraging women to retreat back into the family structures, which they had challenged in 1917. That was introduced in 1944. Hitler did a similar thing in 1939. So it was actually directly like lifted from Hitler's Germany. Really terrible. Homosexuality was also recriminalized in 1933 after having been, you know, decriminalized in 1917. There are many more examples, but in short, every backwards aspect of capitalism that workers had overthrown in the revolution was reinstated one by one, each perversely justified by the supposed needs of socialism, which was in reality just a mask for Russian, you know, state capitalism. And I think it is appropriate to call Stalinist Russia and all the other Stalinist regimes a state capitalist kind of society. The core of capitalism, which was the class relationship between workers and bosses, was in full effect, no matter how many, you know, coats of red paint it was hidden behind. And just like any other capitalism, Russian state capitalism had an interest in competing on the international capitalist world stage. So for this purpose, Stalin kind of repurposed the Communist International, which was this body set up by the Bolsheviks in 1917 to spread international revolution. But under, you know, Stalin's patronage, it became a body solely dedicated to advancing the foreign policy interests of Russia. So the various communist parties of the world, which had been, you know, founded by genuine Marxist revolutionaries, were remolded in the authoritarian image of the Soviet Union's Communist Party. Their leaderships were purged and replaced with Stalin's yes men, and the parties were transformed into organizations with no space for dissent against the party line, which was handed down from Moscow. So these parties, you know, rather than resolutely fighting for workers' revolutions, actually sabotaged revolutions time after time, particularly in countries like China and Spain, where there were workers' revolutions, all just for the interests of serving Russian foreign policy at various points. So for Lenin, international revolution had been the essential prerequisite for socialism in Russia, but for Stalin, it was crushing international revolution that was the essential component of maintaining his regime. So to start to sum up a little bit, so the legacy of Stalinism is still very powerful to this day. Thanks to the existence of numerous Stalinist dictatorships throughout the Cold War period, it became very, very easy for capitalist ideologues to simply go, well, socialism is clearly synonymous with dictatorship, because all of the socialists around the world basically agreed with that statement, and all of the governments who said they were socialists agreed with that statement. A great deal, therefore, of the damage done by Stalinism has been done to the international socialist left, who were left basically bewildered and discredited after having supported authoritarian dictatorships for decades. So many of the ideas which justified these states in their politics still hang around today, still have a legacy. So the most significant hangover from Stalinism, for example, which is still influential, is the tendency for, you know, parties on the left to look up to a higher power to deliver change, whether it be a reformist Labour Party or a capitalist party like the Democrats in the United States, instead of building a radical working class alternative. That's a legacy of Stalinism. Another one is looking to supposed anti-imperialist governments around the world and supporting them. Basically, the whole thing of being an anti-imperialist dictatorship. I mean, there are a million different dictatorships which opposed the US over the years, which basically stole that line from Stalin. They're all basically indebted to Stalin for having the line of, well, we're progressive because we're anti-imperialists because we oppose the US. They were all horrendous capitalist states at the end of the day. So all of these traditions actually flow from, you know, the historical defense of these Stalinist regimes by those who were convinced to defend them throughout the Cold War. And then finally is actually the historical memory of the Russian Revolution itself. Basically, the most liberatory and democratic moment in human history has been completely stained with the legacy of Stalinism, a legacy in actual complete opposition to everything that the revolution had fought for. So Stalinist dictatorship was not the natural, unavoidable outcome of the Russian Revolution, nor does Stalin uphold the project of the revolution. Like Trotsky said, he was its gravedigger. Being a socialist today means seeing through the conflation between Stalinism and socialism, no matter who it comes from. And actually, it's about seeing that a world based on radically democratic working class control over society is still possible, just like it was in 1917. Thanks.